Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Sending in for Andrew Talk this week, I'm Carlotta Rubello. Coming up on today's program.
We always dream of place or leave places like they're always having like this. It's not true. And so it gave us some, I would say, freedom to say, well, maybe now people are going to expect something else that the Champs-Élysées are today.
While we do love our grassroots solutions and guerrilla urbanism on this show, sometimes a large development can be just as inspiring and invigorating for a city as a smaller one. Today, we look at a few grand projets from around the world that could go a long way to getting citizens engaged with their cities again. From a garden transformation on one of the world's most well-known avenues to a reimagining of a famous stretch of water in Los Angeles. All that and much, much more coming up right here on The Urbanist, with me, Carlotta Rubello. So welcome to this week's programme. We begin today in Paris, where an ambitious new project wants to transform one of the city's and the world's most famous avenues, the Champs-Élysées. Under the new plan, around 1.9 kilometres will be turned into a giant urban garden, putting people first. With a price tag of 250 million euros and an expected completion date in 2030, this is the sort of project that could redefine a city for generations to come. Édouard Lefebvre is the general manager of the Champs-Élysées Committee. It's a non-profit organization which gathers nearly 200 entities, from property owners to retail brands and cultural institutions, all that call the Champs-Élysées and its vicinity their home. Through their work, the committee brings together all these different players to take action and transform the area into a better place. And I'm very happy to say that Edward joins me now. Edward, let's start with the very beginning. What is this grand vision here and how did the whole process get started?
When we started our studies at the very beginning, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we went into the Champs-Élysées history. And what is very striking is that the Champs-Élysées haven't been like they are today from ever. It's not true. They change every 20, 30, 40 years. It's a permanent addition of layers, and some activities disappeared. One example, one century ago, the Champs-Élysées were the place where you were happy to buy your fantastic car, which was the high tech of the time. I mean, the Google and the Facebook of the time was the car making industry, which was changing the world. And where do you buy your car in Paris? On the Champs-Élysées. So it's where it was happening. We figure out that we always dream of place or leave places like they're always having like this. It's not true. And so it gave us some, I would say, freedom to say, well, maybe now people are going to expect something else that the Champs-Élysées are today. We thought that people want to stroll on the avenue. People living in cities want to live in their city in a more peaceful way. And that's very striking in the studies we've read and the data we gathered. There's a big change about this. People like 30 years ago, they were ready to jump in a car, go into work, be in the jam, come back. And this is a hard life, but they were okay with it. Now today, people are changing about that. They don't want anymore that kind of life. And furthermore, it's not the best way of life considering the future of our planet. But it's that kind of movement that we observed. And the way we thought it was critical for the Champs-Élysées Avenue is that when we did statistics on people who were visiting the avenue, out of 100, only 4 visiting the Champs-Élysées were from Paris. And so we could have said, well, it's great. It means we'll have got a lot of tourists and people that are coming for another reason than being a Parisian that is strolling on the Champs-Élysées. But the truth is that it's a terrible weakness that is hidden by another success, you know? And so we thought that's bad. And we looked in the history book, and 70 years ago, people from Paris were strolling on the Champs-Élysées, like Marcel Proust was strolling on the Champs-Élysées. He wrote down that in his book, and his mother was saying it's not good for his health. We have photos of the gardens of the Champs-Élysées full of Parisian. And today, during the weekend, the Champs-Élysées gardens are not full of Parisian. I'm sorry, it's not the case. So we thought, what is not there that makes people not coming? So there's no place to do sports. Families doesn't feel safe. Why don't they feel safe? Well, the equipment is not correct. It's not really dangerous. It's because the equipment is not correct. And so step by step, we added a lot of proposals to embetter the avenue. And at the end, we end up with the program Réenchanter les Champs-Élysées, Reenchanting the Champs-Élysées, which has been noticed from Paris to abroad.
This is, of course, an extraordinary project. We're talking about, you know, nearly 2 kilometers that will be transformed into this amazing urban garden in the middle of Paris. Not only talking about, you know, as you described, the history of Champs-Élysées through the years, but even culturally, what that signifies and what that can be for future generations. I'm curious then, for such a big project, I believe it's around 250 million euros. What does it mean to have City Hall behind you? That, of course, adds another layer to all of this.
So last year was the election of the mayor of Paris. And so we had meetings with all the teams and all the candidates, and we made public discussions about their project for the Champs-Élysées and their view about our project. And most of them, from right to left, all of the candidates were either in favor, either very pushy about the work we've done forecasting the future of the Champs-Élysées. The project, okay, we're modest because the project is big in its impact, but we are modest in the fact that I think we are in the trend of what the next decade will design in the cities. All the cities are looking forward, pushing the way people make transportation, bikes, pedestrian, trees. The impact of trees is much more than decorative. It's also to cool down the cities, for instance.
I guess then let's stay with that thought that you just mentioned about, you know, the grand vision. And as a final question to you, let's say we're looking to Paris in 10, 15 years from now. This ambitious project is well underway. What's the city that you picture in your mind?
Oh, I think in less than 10 years, there will be families in the gardens playing with balls and, I don't know, equipments for kids. There will be youngsters having a beer or a cafe on terrace or restaurant. There will be a much more comfortable way of life in the area. You know, the Champs-Élysées area is the central business district, but it has forgotten to be also a lifestyle district, whereas it is for some point. The gardens, the restaurants, there are assets we want to push on. And I think in 10 years, it will be like this. We have also, since the pandemic, we have checked the data about the home office will stay in the habits of the companies. But what we read is that workers want to come to the office some days to keep a social relation with all the teams and so on and so, and also to stay in the middle of the culture of the business. And on the other hand, everybody says, we can easily stay well organized and have 1 to 2 to 3 days of home office. So the line between work and leisure will be much less visible.
Édouard Lefebvre there of the Champs-Élysées Committee. There are, of course, challenges when it comes to designing and planning for a project of this magnitude and significance. So how will all of this look when put to practice? Philippe Kianbacheta is an architect and the founder of PCA Stream, the architecture studio responsible for the project. Philippe, thank you for joining us on The Urbanist. You are tasked with re-enchanting the Champs-Élysées. How does that work?
The Champs-Élysées turned out to be, since a few years now, and even a few decades, a place that the Parisians don't like anymore. And so it's a starting point that maybe if you don't live in Paris, you don't realize. And it's important that, I don't like the Champs-Élysées myself. I mean, I'd never go there. So when they ask me about re-enchanting, I say, well, forget it. There is no way you can re-enchant the Champs-Élysées. It's an avenue that became a place for tourists and foreigners and shopping. And I mean, why as a Parisian should I go there? So the vision was to say, well, if it was this sort of iconic place of modernity and progress, why don't we try today to re-engineer, reverse this movement? And if we were able to imagine some new urban planning, some new way of living in a city there, then it would have an incredible impact because we would repair an icon. How to do that? Well, we found out that in a way, there are three major issues that we should solve. The first one is with traffic and mobilities. The car has killed the Champs-Élysées, clearly. Starting in 1970, like in many cities, given the priority to the car traffic. And that has completely killed this avenue and the garden at the bottom of the avenue. Champs-Élysées is the most noisy avenue in Paris. It is also the most polluted avenue because you have more than 100,000 people crossing it every day with a car, where only a few of them are coming to the Champs-Élysées, or the rest of them are just passing by. So that's insane. So first action would be to reduce that, bring the traffic back two lanes only, and all the garden forbid the car, go around it, but free it from the car traffic. Then the second idea, main idea, is to say how you can also discover what nature is. I mean, all of these are interesting challenge for all cities. It's not just about Paris or the Champs-Élysées. It's an issue, a revolution that we have to do in all cities around the world. The Garden of the Champs-Élysées, we have to replant it completely in a sophisticated way so that we can really reduce the temperature by several degrees. And today is not working there on the Champs-Élysées. And the third one, coming back to human and what we do, this idea of extraordinary garden means that we want to develop four main activities in this garden that are very Parisian also and very French. Culture, of course, is one key element, and we have the Grand Palais and the Petit Palais and La FIAC and a lot of events that are taking place inside the building. But what we observe is that when you go into the FIAC, when you're done, you jump in a taxi or in the subway and you go away. Nobody knows that they are in the middle of 24-hectare garden in the center of Paris. It's crazy. So if you have made this garden nice and accessible, then you will stay there and have art, music, theater taking place in these gardens outside, of course, when it's nice and sunny. The second idea would be about the food. I mean, food is also a French tradition. And we could have on this avenue that is 1 kilometer long in the garden, in the trees, have nice little restaurant, not expensive, with very good quality, that is almost like a dreamland of fooding accessible to everyone. And it could be somehow monitored by the best French chef, and not for expensive restaurant and fancy, but really that anyone could go there and discover excellent cuisine. The third action would be playground for children. It used to be in this Champs-Élysées place where all the family would go in the 19th century, and even in the 20th century. No, it's gone, it's dead. And it's a shame because we could have invented also a lot of creative and new type of playground for the children. And the fourth idea that is, of course, came with the Olympic Games that will take place there in 2024 would be to use this natural space for sport and healthy activity.
Where do you even start? What is the main challenge to begin, you know, dealing with such an ambitious project?
The first challenge was really intellectual because in all I told you, there is no construction, right? What I found interesting first is like building a conceptual framework on how do you tackle something so big. So that was my first question, precisely, how do you handle something so large, both geographically in terms of question? I mean, it seems so complex and vast. So we work on a model to try to understand and modelize what a city is or what the urban fabric is. We study a lot of what's at the moment the research in the world, in different universities, and we create our own conceptual framework saying that this Champs-Élysées neighborhood can be, in a way, simplified. I have five different stacks. One is nature, one is infrastructure, one is architecture, one are the mobility moving from one to another, and at the end, what do you do with it, the usage, heating, working, sleeping, buying, etc. So the result of what you experience as a human being comes from all these different layers that are, of course, interrelated. So we say, okay, what do we want to achieve tomorrow? What do we want the Champs-Élysées to be in 2030 that is not today? And what we want the city of tomorrow to be is once desirable. So re-enchanting is making them desirable again. Inclusive is a second idea, so that it's not creating something so uniquely for very rich people and for a certain category. And, you know, we had the yellow jacket coming up, burning the Champs-Élysées for that very precise reason 2 years ago, is that the big city have become exclusive and a lot of people cannot afford them. And of course, the sustainable.
The Champs-Élysées are a symbol. They're, you know, a national icon for France, for Paris, but also an icon abroad. My final question to you is, what is it like to know that you're working in such a symbolic project that will define the city of tomorrow?
What is very exciting is that this thing was initiated by the private sector, like this committee, which is gathering the people owning a piece of the Champs-Élysées, having a big store there. You have Galerie Lafayette or LVMH or people that are not the city of Paris. They invested and they asked us to develop a vision, like a dream. And the incredible thing that the city of Paris say, okay, that's a great vision. Let's do it. We had to do something with this symbol that in a way, you know, let's remember the last year, you know, that Notre Dame was burning. And I presented this project to the mayor of Paris 2 days after that and said to Anne Hidalgo, you know, the Notre Dame has been burning in 3 hours. And the Champs-Élysées are in a way burning since 30 years of no taking care of them. So before it's too late, we should take care of it.
The architect Philippe Chiambaretta there. This is The Urbanist. To Los Angeles now, where one of the city's biggest stars is set for a dramatic makeover. The Los Angeles River, an 80-kilometer-long body of water that was turned into a mostly concrete channel in the 20th century, has been reimagined by Los Angeles County with landscape studio Olin and the architects Gary Partners and GeoSyntec Consultants. To find out more about the proposed transformation of this iconic landscape, Monocle's Nick Manise spoke with the landscape architect behind the new LA River Master Plan. Here's Olin's Jessica Henson.
The Los Angeles River is 51 miles long. In the right-of-way of the river, from the fence line to fence line, there's about 2,300 acres of land. And to put that in perspective, Central Park in New York City is about 830 acres. And so if you imagine what 2,300 acres of land along the LA River, it's this incredible opportunity zone to move the needle for the residents of Los Angeles. And while the river has long been seen as the backyard, everybody's turned their back to it. In the coming decades, the hope is that the LA River will be this 51-mile connected public open space. So what the LA River Master Plan does is it helps set up a vision, a common vision, based on a series of 9 goals that came from a community process to help with decision-making, to help with funding, and to help different communities see what the opportunities are along the river. And so the one really important thing to remember is there's no 51-mile design solution. It works everywhere along the Los Angeles River. There are actually different hydraulic reaches. So while, you know, we're used to the iconic view, say in like the movie Grease, or you think of Terminator, of say like downtown Los Angeles where the LA River is, there are actually a lot of different sections. Sometimes it's a box channel, sometimes it's a trapezoid. There are a few sections where there's actually a soft bottom where vegetation can grow. So it's really important for the master plan to have different components that are different design scenarios for different sections. When we started looking at the Los Angeles River many years ago, our team, Gary Partners, Lori Olin, myself, Richard Rourke in my office, we also were working with Mark Hanna at GeoSyntec, we really started off from the place of how can we soften the entire river? We really wanted to. And so what we studied was what would it take to widen the channel if we wanted to vegetate the channel. And depending on where you are on the river, it would have to be 2 to 7 times wider. And because the way that the LA River floodplain is so developed, we have a lot of housing, a very dense urban fabric around the LA River at this point, it would cause massive displacement of housing and also critical facilities to do that sort of scale of widening. And the reason why that planting the river would require widening is planting increases the friction. So the concrete channel is smooth, water can flow very smoothly. So what LA County in this plan had to address was really the question of, well, do we look at massive displacement and widening, or do we try to get more creative and think about ways with the system to still have ecological benefit, to still have park space and have all these amenities, multi-benefit flood risk management without displacing people. We are not proposing wide-scale full 51-mile concrete removal. What the plan does consider are where are there places where there is capacity that things can be vegetated? Also, where are there places that through side channels or other things like culverts and tunnels, can we get some of that pressure off of the channel in order to have some native riparian areas along there as well? And then I think another really exciting opportunity of the master plan is thinking about where things like habitat bridges or platform parks could actually bridge over the concrete channel, creating this green ecological connectivity between places where we have habitat linkage needs and actually create some of those spaces above the channel. So we're trying to think in this very multi-benefit matrix that doesn't over-prioritize one category, you know, displacing 50 to 100,000 people. But how do we really think through that? So the master plan is not a naturalization of 51 miles of the river, but rather how do we achieve multiple goals being responsible to the social realities of 2021 that we're in right now? So there's a kit of parts of six high-level typologies that the master plan includes. And then from there, municipalities, the county, state conservancies can work together with local communities in a community engagement process to figure out which of those things are best for their community and their needs. And so what's, I think, really exciting about the master plan is it brings a lot of technical research, a lot of technical feasibility studies, and then allows those to pair with what communities specifically need. So some communities need park space, some communities need flood risk mitigation, some communities need affordable housing. And all of those things have components and they can work together in these multi-benefit ways across categories.
Jessica Henson there from All In Studio. Heading north of the border, we cast our eye to Zibi, a master-planned community in the middle of a river that straddles two Canadian provinces. With an impressive One Planet Living accreditation that shows not just efforts to improve environmental impact, but also to the health and social lives of residents, this community that is taking shape on the Quebec-Ontario border has big aspirations to go with its Best Master Plan Award from the North American Planning Institute. To explain more about the project, this show's regular host, Andrew Tuck, spoke with Jeff Westeinde and Michael Cooper from Dream, who co-developed the site. Andrew began by asking Michael about the background behind the piece of land Zibi sits on.
We have something called the National Capital Region, which is where our federal government resides. It's primarily in Ontario, but about 30% of it is in Quebec. Quebec and Ontario, you know, share a very long border. In 1982, Canada got its own constitution. We asked permission from the Queen, and she said it was okay for us to have our own constitution. And in that constitution, it says that Quebec is a distinct society because of its French background. We've also have a history of First Nations in this area. So we've got a site that's 35 acres. We're going to build out enough space for 6,000 people to work, for 5,000 people to live. There'll be six public parks, six private open spaces. And there's great trails. It's a net zero community on the heating and cooling. It's also, it's partly in the river, partly on the waterfront. This 35 acres has 20,000 feet of waterfront. And our idea was to recognize all three cultures, the First Nations, Quebec and Ontario, and to design one community that addresses all three. So we've gotten completely rid of borders. And we're trying to make a really special 35 acre community that's got historic buildings, has new buildings, cultural center that everybody can claim as their own. So it's really in an opposite direction of historically what's happened. In fact, you're not allowed to carry a case of beer the 300 feet from Quebec to Ontario. The bridge is only 300 feet apart. But other than that, we're trying to just have one society.
And just tell me, one of the things that's being talked about, this 30-acre project, is the idea that it's going to be putting health first, and it's part of something called One Planet Living. For people who don't know these accreditations, and you know, there's lots of them bandied around these days, whether you're a LEED building, for example, what is this and why have you decided to comply with its demands?
Yeah, so one planet, I mean, the name speaks for itself, and that's that humans need to live on this planet as if we only had one planet. And everybody looks at me quizzically when we say that. But the reality is, if everyone lives like an American, we need five planets. Or a Canadian, we need four planets. A European, you'd need three planets to sustain our lifestyle. So one planet, the root of it really is just use your share of the planet's resources and no more. So a number of very aggressive targets around carbon utilization. But the second piece, one of the reasons why we picked one planet over, say, a system like LEED, we have a long history with LEED. My business built Canada's first LEED platinum building and built the first LEED platinum building in three of our provinces. But LEED is very architecture and engineering focused. And we actually had an interesting situation where we put up a LEED platinum building. It was a multi-residential building, sold the units. I went back to visit about 3 years later, and there's a gentleman in a Hummer SUV that was driving into the parking lot of our LEED platinum building. It made me realize that we might have missed the mark. So what One Planet does is it also layers on a whole social lens to it. So we do get rated on things like health and happiness, on community engagement. So if you look at a number of the things that we've done, say around our First Nations engagement, One Planet dictates that we need to do a number of those. On the health and happiness piece that you asked about, it is clear that people's well-being is definitely impacted by their sense of community, and their health is impacted by their sense of community. So simple things like, you know, you can tell how happy somebody is by how many of their neighbors they know by first name. So as we design a community, we create opportunity to engage, get to know each other, the way the buildings are managed, the way that the site is physically laid out, drive that kind of interaction. So that's why we picked One Planet, that we have all of the architectural and environmental demands that you would see in a LEED accreditation, as a for instance, or any of the other ones. But it has this great social lens to it as well.
Michael, let's get the virus question out of the way. You started this project back in 2014. Here you are pressing ahead. Has the past year given you any pause for thought? Because in lots of cities, the debate has been around, you know, will the city bounce back? What's the future of the city? Are people going to flee back to the suburbs? Are people not going to want to live in tight communities and densely? Did you just keep your eye on the horizon and think this isn't going to affect us in the long term? Or have you maneuvered the actual outcome at all to respond to the year we've been through?
It's a great question. And we've got projects in other cities that is more relevant. But this is the nation's capital. The city is a really attractive city. I think, honestly, it's the equivalent of a Nashville or Austin in the States, the kind of cities that thrive. In addition, the site is attached to hundreds of kilometers of bike trails. I mean, it kind of is the city of the future. So I think that thankfully what we designed is very well suited for what seems to be the new environment where people want to be able to have more flexibility, have lots of outdoor space, have a sense of community, but not feel overwhelmed by concrete and great height.
What's the push and the pull here? Because Canada is committed to reducing its emissions under the Paris Agreement by, I think, some 30% against 2005 levels by 2030. You have a growing audience of consumers who are demanding some change, and they want to be seen to be doing good when they spend their money, when they invest in a property, when they go to work, that they're part of something heading in the right direction. And you're the money guys. You obviously want to make some money in this process as well. Is this just a perfect moment when all of these things are coming together? Or do you find yourself being a little bit chased by national government and by provincial government saying, okay, you need to move fast here? Where's the push and where's the pull?
Canada has a policy that they want to recover from COVID in a way that's greener and a way that's fairer for everybody. So the government set out a goal that everybody should have a respectful home by 2030, which is 1.2 million affordable homes. And we're obviously talking about a greener recovery. And there's a big focus on inclusivity, that everybody should have an equal chance. People should be respected. And the amazing thing is real estate has a lot to do with how we can deliver on that. So a community like Zibi and other communities that we're doing really provide a community in the literal meaning, a place where people feel that they belong, that they are attached to. It's inclusive of all income levels. We do a lot of affordable housing. We've signed up to the Operating Principles of Impact Management, which was something started by the World Bank, which is really the foundation of impact investing. And the goal is to invest your money and do well while you're doing well for the planet. And I would say that we used to have more push and pull with the governments. Now I think we're working much closer together to find ways to achieve the shared goal. And the goals are so big that the government can't implement them without developers and investors who are keen to participate. So we need each other. In addition to that, I think one of the big movements is that the largest pools of capital globally are now more focused, not just on ESG, which is measuring the risk to companies on how they do these things, but also measuring the impact, what good is happening from the capital. So you've got sovereign wealth funds that are telling their people how they're using their money to make the world a better place. And you've got reinsurance companies that really suffer the losses from all sorts of climate change issues, wanting to invest their money in projects that were forward thinking. So it actually is a golden moment to be really creative, to try to do things that are wonderful for the planet, wonderful for people who've been left out of our community historically, and quite honestly, to get a decent return when you put it all together right.
Well, Jeff, it's clearly a very simple project. You've shown that there are going to be no hurdles to climb over. Explain to people what the timescale is here. Have people already started moving in? When did they start moving in? How long until completion?
Our first residents moved in 2017, and we've just occupied our second residential building. Our third residential building will be occupied first thing in 2022. Our first commercial spaces were occupied this year. And again, end of this coming year, we've got the National Science and Research Council and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council moving in with 600 employees onto the site. So we are well underway. Our zero carbon utility is up and servicing those buildings. I think between now and call it 10 to 15 years, then we would be fully built out, but really taking the time to make sure that we get every step right along the way. So yeah, within the next decade, then be fairly close to complete. But ZB is currently a place people can go there, visit there. Well, not currently in the pandemic, I guess, but typically we've had over 250,000 visitors on the site visiting some of the attractions that we brought to site, like Cirque du Soleil. We're opening up the very first interprovincial zip line. People will be able to zip from Ontario to Quebec across 600 meters of the Ottawa River while they're looking at Parliament Hill. So lots of attractions on the site to go with the residential and commercial that's already there.
Jeff Steiner there. Before that, Michael Cooper from Dream, speaking with the urbanist's Andrew Tuck. Well, that's all for this week's edition of The Urbanist. Andrew Tuck will be back next week. Today's episode was produced by myself, Carlotta Ribello, and by David Stevens. And David also edited the show. To play you out of this week's episode, here's the Boxer Rebellion with Big Ideas. Thank you for listening, city lovers.